I'd like to welcome you to the study session of Mesa City Council for Thursday, January 29, 2009. I'd like to excuse Councilmember Summers, who's in a training session this morning and will not be joining us, and the Vice Mayor is running just a few minutes late. He will be here. Item number one on the agenda is to review the February 2nd City Council meeting agenda. Page 2, page 3, page 4.
Mayor.
Mr. Richens.
5A has some concerns about 5A. It seems like the what's being written here is trying to streamline Sunshine Acres redevelopment process. And now we're adding a zoning category to allow the group foster throughout the entire city just to help facilitate Sunshine Acres getting their remodeling plan done. Is there another way we can help Sunshine Acres without blanketing the entire city with this new category?
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, basically you are correct. Sunshine Acres was brought into the city several years ago, and we've never really had a zoning category that really directly covers what they do and how they do it. And so we have been working with them to create a mechanism so that we can facilitate their continued operation and expansion of that facility. And the way we have come up with does allow somebody else who comes up with the same type of operation in the same type of zoning to do a similar project. But it'd have to be very much the same type of operation.
I think I'd feel a lot more comfortable just helping Sunshine Acres and not creating a new zoning category for this.
John, what other options would there be available to do just specifically? Is there
one other option that we discussed briefly was the idea of a PAD, a planned area development based zone, where you could then zone it this. I think we're actually considering calling it a PD, plan development, and you basically tailor your development project according to how you structure that PD. So that would, again, be something that would be useful in a variety of settings for a variety of different types of development throughout the city. It's difficult to create a zone that just covers one thing in your community. Once you create any kind of category, anybody else who meets that same situation is going to be able to use it somewhere else in the community.
Is, Mr. Wesley, is this driven by the zoning or the site plan or a combination of the two? Because even if you do a PAD, how does a Sunshine Acres type of thing come in over time and add a building here and a building there without coming in and amending their PAD?
Mayor, that would depend upon how specific they could be at one time when they would come in and develop a proposal. They could do it with a lot of expansion opportunities, and then if they deviate from that, they would maybe have to come back in time to deviate from what was approved at one point in time.
Well, you know, you think of the example at Banner Mesa where they're remodeling floor by floor by floor, but they're still allowed to occupy the building and operate business on the site even while they're in the midst of remodeling other floors. Is there something in that approach that could help Sunshine Acres? Sunshine Acres is a great operator. They do great work. I'm just not sure I'm ready to completely open the door to a lot more of this. Yet.
Well, I guess once again, is it a zoning type issue that's our problem, or is it a site plan, an actual where we place buildings on?
Mayor, it is
once the zoning opens up.
It is a zoning issue as well as a site plan, but we have nothing currently in our regulations that really allows that type of use that they have, and so we are trying to address
what
the
is
basic
the,
use question.
Just so everyone knows, Sunshine Acres, because they came in, we accepted the zoning that they had. What was that zoning?
Okay. And at this point, I'm going to Mr. Sheffield, he's got a little bit more of the background, history,
R1,
and details
R190.
Of it. So.
I'm just want everyone to understand that.
Mayors, members of the council, Sunshine Acres is currently zoned R190, which is a single residence district on basically 2-acre lots. Obviously, they're not a single residence on a 2-acre lot. What we have is a situation in which the zoning was established after annexation in Maricopa County. Maricopa County had a special use permit process, and in Maricopa County, when you at that particular time, you can request a special use permit for any activity that's not otherwise authorized under the zoning ordinance. Mesa's special use permits and council use permits don't work that way. We specify which activities can be requested for the use permit as opposed to anything goes. And the county has also modified its ordinance since this annexation to go by a similar system, so you can't do that anymore in the county. When we annexed the property, we established the R190 district. They've been considered a legal nonconforming use for all this time, and technically they probably should have rezoned, or we probably should have done this code amendment several times quite a while ago. However, we've kind of done these small incremental, yeah, you can go ahead and do this, because everybody's understood that Sunshine Acres is a worthwhile project, and we didn't necessarily feel that they should be going through rezoning every time they were doing small little things. Well, the small little things have added up, and it's gotten to the point where we really need to kind of address the primary issue, which is how do you zone a use like that, which is why this code amendment is here.
Other than Sunshine Acres, which not only is a worthwhile, it seems to me like it's a very unique situation.
Sure.
I'm trying to figure out when else we would have in the city someone coming in on 10 acres or more and doing this kind of a function or an action. Has there been anyone come in to try and
No, there's not. In fact, the reason the ordinance amendment is written the way that it's at is that if we do get someone who does want to emulate Sunshine Acres and wants to follow a similar type of procedure, then they can do that. It just, we want to make sure that they're following the same protocol.
So I'm still trying to understand why. I mean, I understand that we're sort of in a limbo, but isn't that a limbo that seems to be working?
It is, but it's not. There's rather strict nonconforming rules that we've been kind of winking at, quite honestly. And we really haven't been following our own rules. And so what we're trying to do is to say, rather than redo the entire nonconforming statutes of the zoning ordinance, we're trying to create a zoning category that is unique enough that it addresses the Sunshine Acres situation, but it's not so unique that people can be coming in and requesting these tomorrow.
Okay, do you believe this will make, will this add any burden to Sunshine Acres, or will this make it easier for Sunshine Acres, or is this neutral as far as regulation goes?
Their attorney is Ralph Pugh. In my understanding and discussions with Mr. Pugh, is they've done much of the work that we've already requested, so there shouldn't be any additional burden. They'll come in and they'll request a special use permit if the council agrees this code amendment should go through. Once the special use permit is in place, we're good to go. They'll have the master plan in place. They'll come in and get their building permits as needed.
And that can just fit right in with the zoning that we would establish, so it would actually make it easier for them.
And actually, we're not even changing the base zoning district.
Right.
All we're asking for is a special use permit.
Okay.
Yep. Can we just create like an SA zone for Sunshine Acres? I mean, no, the attorney's saying no. I'm just worried that we're opening the door to a lot of, but I mean, it is written pretty narrowly, and you know, to find a lot of 10-acre parcels that would qualify would probably be difficult, but I don't know.
Mayor, if I could just add to Mr. Richens' comments, the other parts of this that tend to be relatively narrow are some of the programming aspects of this. In addition to the 10-acre minimum requirement, it's also a requirement they have a minimum of 25 beds. They have to be licensed by the state of Arizona. In addition to that, they have to have on-site educational facilities in addition to recreational facilities and some of the other things. And that's fairly unique to Sunshine Acres. That doesn't usually happen in most group homes.
Are there any other cities that have similar situations, and how they handle them?
My understanding, and I've just kind of a casual glance at some of the other zoning ordinances throughout the city, Sunshine Acres is a relatively unique circumstance, and they don't have youth residences that are quite as large as Sunshine Acres. So they haven't had a need for a similar type of zone. That's why we've had to create the special use permit that we've done.
Okay. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I guess I have just a philosophical concern with creating a zoning category for one user, because sometimes that can have unintended consequences, I mean. And my question is if, for example, Maricopa County Juvenile Court wanted to have a youth residence on 10 acres with 25 beds for juveniles who had been adjudicated through their system as being dependent or needing to be under the auspices of the court. This would seemingly also permit them to operate under the zoning category. Am I correct?
I'll defer to the city attorney. My understanding is, however, if it's actually operated by the county, we may not have any jurisdiction.
Mayor and Council, I'm going to ask Donna Bronski to, she's been working on this project. She'll address the question.
Mayor and Council, it very well might. The other part of that particular scenario is that the county probably wouldn't be subject to our zoning laws anyway. So,
well, I guess I could ask it. Let me ask it a different way. What if the county had a contractual arrangement with a nonprofit to run the home again, pursuant to placement by the juvenile court into those facilities? Because again, we see that, for example, with a New Leaf has group residences. It's much smaller, mm-hmm. but they're placed there by the court. But I would think there's still, again, there could be the possibility of that occurring, whether this use would be permitted if that would be the contractual arrangement.
Mayor, Councilmember Cavanaugh, a couple of things in that particular scenario. If it's a contractual situation, a couple of things have to happen. One, a rezoning case more than likely will have to happen. Mm-hmm. Second, they'll have to have a special use permit approved for the Board of Adjustment. Both of those require public hearings. I suspect that because of the relative low amount of property within the city of Mesa has a base zone of R190 already, that's why they would have to rezone. And so from that standpoint, the council would obviously have to see that and have to agree to it before we could even go through that. That would not be just a staff-driven process or process that would only be heard by the Board of Adjustment.
Could we get a before this starts moving, could we get a map that shows what our potential sites are? Where could this actually occur?
I guess, yeah, and we can, I saw Mr. Brady nodding, yes, we could do that. I guess other than to try and be nice and clean, I'm wondering, it seems to me like it's no harm, no foul. I mean, what if we just continue on the way we are? We're going to shut down Sunshine Acres for a legal nonconforming use? I guess, you know, I understand the desire to maybe clean things up. Maybe I'm asking a loaded question. What if we do nothing?
Mayor, let me start with, it's always best to have people in compliance as opposed to
sure.
not in compliance. I guess my second question to Gordon would be, would their expansion be impacted or restricted if this is not approved?
It may be better to talk to Mr. Pugh and the Sunshine Acres Works about this. The site plan that they've shown me.
Was this driven by us or by Sunshine Acres? Who first proposed it?
It's a combination of both. We've been doing this wink and a nod system for a while now, but what's happened is that the types of expansions they've been proposing are, each one has been relatively small. I mean, it's one manufactured house on the property here, or it's a small expansion to their office over here, or it's a small expansion to their warehouse over here, and it's been these little incremental things. The master plan that they have that they've presented to me is significantly different than what they're doing now. They're talking about individual dormitories, expansion in terms of the number of dormitories. It's fairly significant expansions. It's not small incremental units, which is
so. What I'm getting is you're believing that if we clean this up, this would actually be a benefit to them because it would clean up the process, and
yes.
we wouldn't have to be tiptoeing around this hodgepodge of law that we now have as it relates to that specific site.
That's correct.
Okay, all right, I get it. Okay, Mr. Hitchens, what would you?
Maybe give us an opportunity to meet with the applicant
okay.
on this, and I'd like to talk to Mr. Pugh. And
let's see if we can get Mr. Pugh in here before Monday.
Understanding. I want to also understand how many sites are that potentially could fall into this category, because it may be very limited, and it may be impossible. And if that's the case, then This isn't going to be a problem.
Yeah, if I understand where you're coming from, you don't want the unintended consequence of doing something which all of a sudden somebody can walk into and say, oh, it is established, so I'm going to use it to establish something else.
Mesa is the new home for every foster care facility in the state.
All right, if we can see if we can get with Mr. Pugh and somebody else from Sunshine Acres.
I think I'd prefer to not introduce it because it may be modified in some way. So if we didn't introduce.
Yeah. There's no. We're not under no time conditions or anything other than self-imposed. Well, there's no case right now that is looking for this change to be able to go through or anything.
There's not.
Okay. Well, let's see if we can get something before Monday. If we don't have anything, then we can look at delaying the actual introduction past Monday. If you can get it, then we'll put it on. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Anything else on page 4? And page 5. Okay. We'll now move on to item 2 on the agenda. Discuss and provide direction on the proposed pawn shop and secondhand dealer's transaction fee. Is this the first time we've talked about this?
And Mayor, really, the reason this item is on here, we wanted just to, if you notice back, I'm sorry, back on the council agenda, we just reviewed 5B. Is the item for introduction of ordinance that will be defined, provide the definition for secondhand dealers, and we've provided, I believe, that backup into the council's material. I guess we just want to get clarification as we move forward on Monday with that item. Then the next step would be to move forward on the February 17th, which would then receive have three items on that agenda, which would include the ordinance that was previously introduced, allowing us to charge a fee for both the pawn shops and the secondhand dealers. You would then also have, assuming if this item were passed on February 2nd, you would then also have the definition of items that would be subject to the fee for secondhand dealers. And the third item would be the imposition of the $3 fee that would be applied as we've received direction from council currently for both pawn shops and secondhand dealers. We know that there's been some discussion about whether or not that's going to go apply to both, but I just want to make it clear that's where we're headed. That's the current direction that we're pursuing as far as the items that you will see on your agendas going forward, both for the February 2nd as well as February 17th.
Mr. Nady, have anything else to present or say, or are you just here to answer questions?
Here to answer questions. Well, quit hiding. Get over here.
Since this is about the eighth or ninth time we've dealt with this, does this issue now qualify as a secondhand issue? Going to start charging for it?
I think it may be an antique, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
It's an antique. Okay, gentlemen, Councilmember Fenter.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. You had something to say.
I do. I have a strong opinion on this. I just want to be, and I appreciate. I feel how long this has gone. For me, I'm having a real trouble with expanding this to the secondhand stores, at least initially. The way I looked at it, and I know we have a big agenda, so I'll try and be as briefly as possible. The original request was to come in. We want to take this system online, electronic. The labor-intensive process that the police staff are going through is pretty ridiculous, and we could probably be better utilizing that staff out in the field doing what they need to be doing. cost recovery. And for me, if you take that very simple issue, the way it was originally presented, I agree. I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that it should be electronic. It should have a cost recovery to the city, and I was real good with that. The pawn lobby has come in. They've visited with different council members, and they have a compelling argument. What I would like to see, and I think there's a perfect opportunity here, I know this council to be very business-friendly. And I think there would be an opportunity here to be able to reach out to that secondhand store, secondhand dealers in the community, and have our police department, which has an outstanding reputation dealing with these folks, by the way, work with them. Let them know that there is consideration in place. We've taken care of the pond industry, which is state mandated through state law to be able to required to report. But there's a concern in the secondhand stores. Let's be proactive. I would advocate business friendly. Tell them, hey, get your house in order. Work with the police department. And reevaluate after 6 months or a year with clear documentation and be able to say that come back to council and look at see if we need to expand this service. And I'm hoping it's a reasonable approach. I think it would get back to the very simple part of what we were trying to do, which is somewhat controversial to begin with, and then go from there. So, Mayor, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
You
were first, but if you want to defer to him, I'll...
No, that's fine. I haven't been called a gentleman yet today, so I'm starting off a good day so far. You know, Chief Denny, I just had a general question on the ordinance on page one. I wasn't able to find a period in the sentence, so I honestly didn't know what you were trying to say here. They're like, it's a paragraph, and I read it about three or four times.
That's what happens when lawyers write.
Yeah. So can you tell me, did you miss a period in the sentence? Or is there a comma? I mean, I don't understand what you're saying.
Actually, Mr. Schaefer wrote that, so he could probably answer the punctuation question.
Well, Mayor Councilmember Higgins, I do notice there is a period at the very end.
But, take a deep breath.
But other than that, unfortunately, this definition lends itself to a long definition. As you can see, our existing definition right now was very expansive, and the current definition that's up for introduction is also
so. You know, my question is: says any person, and then there's a whole bunch of others. Where does the sentence pick up again to where I would know what person we're talking about? You know, any person other than five sentences.
About five or six lines from the bottom. There's a period after the word business.
So what people are we talking about when we talk about secondhand dealers?
Well, what we're talking about is that people are defined by the transaction rather than people.
All right. And so let me clarify what I understand this to be, and I honestly think it's a good plan. This is very specific on items. Secondhand dealers would have to report items that have serial numbers on them, items that are owner-applied serial numbers, and items of $100 or more. That's all the only three things that a secondhand dealer would have to report on.
With the one caveat that Arizona statutes require that anyone who deals in precious items, which generally will have a value of $100 or more, must report those as well, and that already exists. So based on value, we would assume they would fall into that $100 area.
So we're talking about three specific things. We're not discussing books, CDs, general knickknacks, all that type of thing someone might turn in. Serial numbers.
Right. The key here, I think, is value and identifiability. That's really what we're looking for. As I think we've said in other meetings, someone bringing in a couple of pairs of jeans or some CDs, there's really not a lot that we can do with that in terms of tracking that down if it turns out that there's some issue about it. This ordinance, just so you know, Councilmember Higgins, is very, very similar to that Phoenix has. In fact, I think we use almost exactly the same criteria that Phoenix uses for.
They don't use periods either?
No.
Probably not. There were lawyers involved there as well. That's easy for me to say, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's fairly common, and I think it's fairly consistent, at least between Phoenix's ordinance and this one, that we would be regulating a very narrow layer of transactions.
And is this shown to help in Phoenix? Because, I mean, the understanding is, you know, like I go buy a golf club at Play It Again Sports, assuming it's not stolen, and then I go pawn it. I've never been in a pawn shop, but I could learn how. I go pawn that, and they tell me it's stolen goods. So those are the kind of things where we could actually happen in this currently.
Sure.
Average citizen picking something up, and then it's actually stolen.
And I mean, if you drill down, what you'd have to be looking for, obviously, is something that's unique that identifies that club, you know. But The difference, obviously, between pawn and secondhand is pawn reports everything. Any even the CDs and the Levi's that we've talked about. If someone comes in and secures a loan or trades that or sells it, they'll have to report it. Not that we'll be able to do anything with it, but they'll have to report it. For secondhand dealers, we're exempting that because that's not covered. The pawn stuff's covered under state statute. Secondhand dealers is not. We're really creating the regulation for secondhand dealers.
I really think this is a great first step at expanding and covering a whole segment in our city that possibly could be dealing in, you know, a way of getting rid of stolen goods. So I support this. And what are you shaking your head?
I'm just looking at the knitted brow of the mayor. Oh.
Knitted brow now? I was just going to turn it over to Councilmember Richens, and then I'll chime in.
I think some of the, as it's written, there's some key exemptions for secondhand dealers. Like I have some antique dealers, and there is some concern amongst the antique dealers in my district that, oh my goodness, you know, am I going to have to report everything I do? But it seems like, as I've read it, and I want to just clarify this with you, that if they go to an estate sale somewhere in Mesa and they buy some antique goods for their store, are those covered under?
It's Mayor, Councilmember Richens. There is an exemption that we picked up from the Phoenix model that does talk about the provisions, the reporting provisions don't apply to secondhand dealers' purchases of household items from a place of residence. So yes, that would include
as long as they buy by check or have some kind of receipt associated.
Right, right. There's certain criteria that they have to meet, but as long as that's followed, yes, those sales, the estate sales, should be covered.
But if somebody brings in a piece of jewelry over the counter to an antique dealer,
right,
then that falls.
Would have to report not only under this, but under state statute, because that probably qualifies as a precious item that the state already requires them to report.
Oh, okay. So they may be, even if it's a second-hand dealer, the state's already requiring them to report.
Well, what the state has done is said that anyone who deals in this item called precious items, which is jewelry, gold, stones, things like that, they have to report those transactions, unless I believe they're trading between wholesalers and jewelers in terms of manufacturing. But that's already covered by state statute. So this would not create a new responsibility for them that statute doesn't already require.
Oh, okay.
Right. In fact, Mayor Councilmember Richens, if I could just follow up on your point about the antique dealers. The current code specifically listed antique dealers as secondhand dealers. What we've done in the definition is go global and start with the definition of a secondhand dealer is everybody but. Instead of specifically listing people who are secondhand dealers, we're saying it's everybody but. So there's no specific reference to dealers and precious items, so no specific reference to antique dealers. It's everyone but.
Okay. Okay. The key part of what you said is I think the exemption or the already existing requirement on precious items, and some people may be unwittingly not reporting when they should be under state statute, not ours, but under the state. And I don't want to, you know, some of these people run a little antique booth somewhere in an antique mall and unwittingly fall into a buying stolen property. I don't think they want to do that either. And, you know, keeping the eye on the prize in this thing is limiting the, what do they call it, fencing of stolen property? It's my police term I got from TV. I think we've done a really good job of narrowing that down. And, you know, do we have some provision that we're going to review how this is working sometime soon? You know, as we kick it in, let it work for 6 months and evaluate.
We could certainly do that in maybe public safety committee, maybe review opportunity to do that. I don't want to add things to your committee.
Trying to add a level of comfortability.
What we really need to do, though, is
it
may take a little bit longer that only because we've set the once we set this in fee in place, then we'll have to go through the procurement process for electronic database and system. Okay. So, no, I agree we should come back. It may be a little bit longer than that, but certainly we can work with the committee on coming up with a reasonable time once it's put in place and seeing how it's working.
Marvelous. Thank you.
Vice Mayor?
We don't want to lose focus on what this is all about in the first place. It is to get the electronic recording in to make sure we track items so that we can prevent the sale of stolen goods. That's what we're really after here. We don't want to get muddied down because what's really written in this is state statute now. We're just trying to improve the recording aspect to get more real-time availability of information that will help us in reducing fencing of stolen items. So I think we need to go ahead and move forward.
I want to go back to something you said in the previous introduction or previous presentation that sort of gives me cause and a little bit of worry. I think you were asked if we had a problem right now with secondhand dealers. And if I recall, the answer was basically not really, or we don't know. Did I misunderstand that?
No.
I don't know if those are the exact words.
We do occasionally, as Detective Milburn testified stated once before here, we do routinely, or not with some routine, recover stolen property or questionable items from secondhand dealers. But we really don't know the scope of the problem because very few of them are reporting. The only ones that are reporting right now, I think there's 38 out of 87 in the city that are reporting. And they're doing that voluntarily, other than the precious items we've talked about. So we really don't have a feel, I don't think, empirically, as to where we are with the quote-unquote problem with stolen goods going through the secondhand stores. Because if it doesn't qualify as a precious item today and they don't choose voluntarily to report, we don't have any information on it. We do recover stuff, Mayor, from time to time. And I think we had recovered something just a couple of weeks ago, a large quantity of construction material or construction tools that were taken to a secondhand store, and we were able to recover those and get them back to the owner. So it does happen, and it happens in the pawn shops as well. But we don't have those numbers because we don't have any regulation of that right now. So
I guess I'm just worried about, we don't have the numbers. It would seem like if there was an overwhelming amount of activity that we would come upon them more often, and the fact that we can't identify and say this is a real problem. We've talked about how this maybe, this could be. We can create hypotheticals where, yeah, I guess if somebody went out and bought something and traded it with their third aunt and then ended up at a pawn shop that did this or that we could have a problem. I guess I'm just a little worried about extending an entire layer of regulation to an entirely new industry that really came up as an afterthought as we start talking about the pawn shops. And basically it was, well, wait a second, there are others who do similar to what we do, but they're not in the pawn business. And I guess I have a real question as to whether we should jump to regulating and throwing our net of government to a problem that might exist, rather than one that has been identified as truly existing, like we have with pawn. We know that. We know there's a structure. We know that there have been things that's documented. I just don't see that with the second hand, and especially we have struggled for several weeks now on, number one, the definition of what a second hand dealer is, number two, what items will be covered. And I guess I'm a little worried that if you struggle that much to define the problem you're trying to alleviate, you know, it should tell you that maybe you're overstretching. Councilmember Richens has been dying to make a comment to that.
So I just don't agree with you at all on this.
That is allowable on this council.
To me, the key thing that was fleshed out this morning was precious items. And they're already covered under state statute.
Right.
And not all dealers are reporting precious items. I think this is setting up a mechanism to capture precious items. Because really, that's what's the biggest concern about the sale of stolen goods is under those precious items. And if they're already regulated by the state, we need to make sure that we're not going to create by hitting the pawn shops harder. You know, people are going to, what are the entropy, go down to the lowest level. Okay, what's the next? If I can't go to a pawn shop, then where can I go? Oh, I can go to eBay or I can go to secondhand dealers. Well, obviously eBay is going to be difficult for us to get our arms around. So secondhand dealers could unwittingly be the place of choice for stolen property. And I think I can feel certain that all of our secondhand dealers do not want to be in that situation, do not want to regulate secondhand dealers. And this gives them a layer of protection from being put in that situation.
What happens if somebody doesn't? I mean, I get it with the precious side. That's state law. What about all the other items? I mean, what if they don't report?
There's no penalty at this point, Your Honor. There's nothing there. They simply can go on about their business and only report precious items, and we'll have no idea what's going in and out.
No, but I mean, with this ordinance, just so everyone knows, what is the penalty for a secondhand dealer to not report? Because let's say we get into a disagreement over the value of an item. I mean, it's secondhand, even if it's an antique or something like that. Let's say there's a gray area. What is the downside if a secondhand dealer doesn't report?
As in the current code and as in the proposed ordinance on the new definition, it's a criminal offense to violate any provision of Title V, Chapter 7.
Okay, so, it's a criminal offense.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically have a strict liability kind of situation where there could be no criminal intent, but just by failure to fill out a thing in a gray area, we could turn a secondhand dealer into a criminal.
Mayor, that's not completely accurate. Unlike the Phoenix Code, who specifically states that it's a strict liability offense, the Mesa Code actually has an exception for what I'll call Scrivener's error, typographical errors, things like that. So it is.
Well, it's not in the way they report, but if they fail to file a form.
Right.
Okay.
Isn't it illegal for anybody to buy stolen goods?
Last time I checked, yes.
It's annoying.
I mean, even if you're not a secondhand dealer,
well,
I think at a garage sale and I buy stolen
property. But I think the mayor's point is well taken when we talk about individuals doing this. We would still have to show some specific intent on their part and knowledge. I mean, that's why we went through all of the things about entrapment and predisposition and things like that when we've run sting operations in the past. We have to be able to show that the person knowingly is doing that. Here it's different. This is really a regulatory issue. And it really creates that framework you've talked about that allows us perhaps to get to the numbers you're talking about, Mayor. What is the problem in secondhand? Quite frankly, right now we can tell you of the 38 areas what we've got and what we haven't. The other 49 that are out there, we don't have a clue.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
I would agree with Councilmember Richens where, you know, we don't know there's a problem because we haven't even looked at it. So to go ahead, put the program into place and review and whatever you think is a proper review time, 6 months after it goes in, 8 months. And if there is no problem, then there's nothing that says we can't change the secondhand dealer reporting. But if there's, you know, obviously if there's a problem, then we continue to move on.
Okay. Councilmember Fenter, you got something else? Councilmember Fenter.
Well, I know it's brief. To counter, why start the regulation? Councilmember Higgins. Why not go out and find the problem, document it? We empower you to evaluate all 70-something of these. And Chief, you know, if you guys had come...
The problem, Mr. Fenter, is that we have no lawful right to go in and go through their inventories now. And without some probable cause, it would have to be a criminal standard for us to do that. I can't walk into a vendor today and say, break out all your receipts and let me look at them because there's no regulatory scheme for that. So the only time we would actually be able to do that legally is if we developed a criminal case against one of those secondhand dealers and then went back in a criminal process. So we're kind of in that. I mean, it's a big gulf between what we can do with regulation and what we can do without regulation.
If I can follow up, Mayor. Chief, you guys are sharp. You have sharp detectives. If this was a problem, it would have come initially. This has evolved for a different reason. We're all kind of dancing around it. If Mesa PD had come to me and said, we need this, we need to expand these powers, I'd believe it. If it was a scrap metal, everybody gets that. I think it's just evolving for some different reasons. So thanks, Mayor.
Okay.
Well, what different reasons are those? You got me perplexed.
I think originally, you know, without getting into it too much, is came in with a very clean, combined... I think the pawn lobby has had a lot of influence. They've met with all of us. And they have a compelling argument that, hey, if it's us, why not everybody else? I was kind of taken back on the original introduction that suddenly everybody's happy. And by the way, can we spread now these costs everywhere? I just feel that there's more to it, not from the council side, but from outside influencing individuals. It's getting bigger than what I think it was originally meant to be.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. We'll move on to the next item. Item number three, hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the development of a regional emergency transportation contract. Chief Harry and Chief Mary. Welcome.
Thank you. Well said.
It's always tough to follow the pawn shop discussion.
That's right.
Mayor, members of the council, good morning. The purpose of our presentation this morning is to discuss and receive direction from council on a plan we've been working on with the town of Gilbert, Queen Creek, and the Apache Junction Fire District that would potentially establish a regional model for emergency ambulance services within our community. As you know, fire departments have operated under the automatic aid system for many years to provide both fire and EMS services. We see this step as a natural progression of that process. Just let me very briefly give you a history of what's happened in the ambulance business in the last 20 or 30 years. Back in 1976 through 1989, all the ambulance companies, there were six or seven of them, were on a rotation basis. Depending on the rotation, a certain company would be called to send an ambulance. That really put us at a disadvantage in terms of response times because there was no way to know where they were in relation to the call. Plus, the creative environment or the competitive environment that was active at that time really was dysfunctional in terms of our ability to do emergency transportation in the best interest of the patient. So we see this as a progressive step to move basically us to go together with the other communities to become a regional emergency ambulance system. And then in 1990 to the present, there's been a sole provider system. Basically, each community does an RFP and contracts with a separate provider. We have begun to see in some cases where competitive companies will receive the bids and share a border, and we're not experiencing the cooperation and the integration that we think was necessary and really quite a basic standard for our community in terms of automatic aid and EMS services. So that's kind of a brief introduction. I'm going to let Mary go into a little more detail on what we're trying to accomplish here and what the benefits are.
Thank you, Chief. First of all, the mission of this whole project of this regional contract is to enhance customer service. That's our ultimate goal in this whole thing. The council, the mayor, city management has challenged us all with evaluating what we do in our processes here in our department, and I think we're taking on that task very seriously. This is one of the issues that we are looking at and how to improve it and what we can do with it. So transportation is one of the areas in our department that we're evaluating. Our responsibility is to look ahead, and that's what we're doing. Chief kind of gave you a brief overview of where we were, where we are, and where we're going to be, where we want to be, and this is our responsibility, and we're looking at that. Also, one of our responsibilities and our mission is to continue to be innovative. We haven't done this before. We don't know if it has been done before regionally, and so we're looking at this to be innovative as well. Our goal is to improve the process. We've outgrown our current system, and so we want to improve where we are. Some advantages to doing this regional contract: it's going to reduce response times. The closest unit will be dispatched to the call, regardless of the city boundary it's in. The seamless transportation that we're going to have with the cities that are cooperating in this, there will be no boundaries here. So whatever ambulance is closest, regardless if it's in Gilbert, Apache Junction, or Mesa, that unit will get dispatched to the call. This really coincides with how we do automatic aid right now. We've been doing automatic aid for years with the fire departments here in the valley. There are no boundaries. That is really a success for the patients and the ones that are injured. That's how we're looking at the transportation system to work the same way. A unified mission for the East Valley. It's going to be unified in many ways, not only with the transportation being seamless, but the equipment that is going to be on these ambulances will be the same. The staffing levels, whether it's ALS, which is advanced life support, meaning paramedics on the units, or basic life support, EMTs on the units, that will be universal. Sometimes they have BLS units, sometimes they're ALS units. That changes our operation when one ambulance comes. That's different than how we operate today. So those will be advantages to the system. Continuity of medical care. Right now in the valley, as fire departments, we work together in doing our training, our medical training, things like that. This will be continuity of medical care with the private provider as well. We'll have the same types of treatment that we do. Sometimes in different valleys, different departments, we do different types of medical care and treatment of what we can do. This will be universal and more fluid.
Chief, I think Councilmember Richens has a comment.
I'm sorry.
Just a quick question. Under the basic life support and the advanced life support, do these four cities all use the same model? Are they all on advanced life support?
Yes, they all are on advanced life support, although sometimes we get units that come in that are basic life support. And we don't all have the same equipment.
How does that affect our staffing if the ambulance shows up?
BLS.
Yeah, under advanced life support, like if there's an EMS and
sure,
paramedics.
Sure.
And do all the cities that we have automatic aid agreements all work the same staff advanced life support like we do? Are there any other cities that have a policy of just basic life support? So everybody's advanced.
Well, Councilmember Richens, if you're referring to the emergency medical service system that the fire department provides, the answer is all fire departments provide paramedic level service. If you're talking about the contracts they have with the ambulance companies, some do provide paramedic backup and some do not. And when those that do not provide that backup interface with our system, then it puts us at a disadvantage in not being able to transfer a patient to another paramedic for transport to the hospital. And when that occurs, then it reduces our staffing and our ability to provide advanced life support in our city.
What cities does that have, when does that happen? When do we have to add our people to the ambulances?
Right now, the condition exists between us and the city of Tempe. There are some areas of Chandler, when we would attempt to run, Chandler would run in with us, that we would have the same problem. So it's more of an automatic aid situation where the interface between the communities can break down and we would have this development. What we're trying to do with the regional contract is avoid that whole situation.
Well, you'd eliminate it because you'd have a consistent standard because you'd have a single contract.
Exactly.
Correct.
And it would be built in so that at least between these four communities, there would be no difference in service levels.
But we have this difference with Tempe, though. It would still exist with Tempe.
Mayor, Councilman Richens, that's, if you would, that may be one of the reasons that this coalition is really coming together. Another one of the reasons, not the only reason, but it's certainly looking at some of the issues we have with other cities that have chosen to choose a different level of service and how it sometimes affects us in automatic aid as far as our own resources. our preference is, because a lot of our activity obviously is with this group that we're talking about here, is we want to make sure we get it right as a group and really treat it as one entity, as one contract. Moving forward, we think there's a tremendous amount of advantages to doing that, especially after we've seen some of the procurement initiatives that have taken place in other cities with similar service. And, you know, that's to be expected. If you have each and individual city going out and procuring services, even if it's from the same vendor, they may be requesting different levels of service, different levels of care, whatever it might be, and then that begins to create challenges in an automatic aid system where there, you know, with the idea that you're running across borders providing service, but then all of a sudden that service is different and how that vendor may be providing or what the requirements are to provide that level of care is different across jurisdictional boundaries. Right. You can see where it could create some complications.
Well, it actually provides, it hurts or provides a disadvantage to that city that's providing the higher level of service.
Right.
Because then they're required at all times to provide their highest level, whereas the adjoining community gets by with maybe a lower level. So, Councilman Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I was on the council when automatic aid really came into being here in the East Valley, and I think it's proved a benefit. Although I will agree with Councilmember Richens that the decision in Tempe to offer a lower level of service with their particular current vendor has created some significant challenges for us in a whole variety of ways in terms of use of personnel and money, and quite frankly doesn't serve, I think, the general public or either community well. I think what we're doing here is a very positive template for the region, and to me it's a natural progression of the concept of automatic aid, because the emergencies people experience again don't respect political boundaries, don't care about political boundaries, but what they want is consistent, timely care and an effective use of resources throughout the community. I don't think that moving to a regional concept like this is any negative commentary on our current vendor, which from all perspectives provides very stellar service to the community and good cooperation with the partner. Am I correct in that regard?
That's correct, Councilmember Kavanaugh. We have received very good service from our current provider, Southwest Ambulance. But we see this whole ambulance market becoming very much more competitive. And what we're trying to do is basically avoid a system where there's inconsistencies that make patient care, that compromise patient care ultimately.
Thank you. Mayor, I think this is a very positive step, and I do support what the staff is recommending.
Thank you.
Thank you. If I could add on to what Councilmember Kavanaugh said, and to kind of answer your question again in a different way, Councilmember Richens, is that right now we all four of our communities have the same provider, but that might not be that way tomorrow. As soon as everybody's contract is up, we all have individual contracts, and as soon as one city's contract is up, they might, a whole different provider may come in, and they will run into the same issues that we just discussed with Tempe. So right now, we all have the same.
I don't want to get into much, but just so those people who don't understand, we talk about service levels. As I understand it, Tempe's contract with their ambulance mm-hmm. provider does not require, for example, paramedics on their ambulances when they show up, which means when we cross lines to give an automatic aid, we have to make sure that we're staffed fully with paramedics, whereas our ambulances, we do have paramedics on. So
that's correct.
There is that different level of service that when we go across the, when our fire units go across the border to answer a call under the automatic aid in Tempe, we have to make sure that we have the highest level of personnel in our trucks to fill in basically for what we perceive as that lower level. Is that an accurate description?
Our staff stays tied up.
Yeah, and that basically could create a situation where our staff is tied up, filling that void.
Sure, because then you have to ride into the hospital, and then your unit is down to three people while you're riding into the hospital until that paramedic gets back to the station.
Exactly. Whereas in our situation, we would have that paramedic. Just an example, not better or worse, just that's how they chose to go about
sure.
their way.
Sure.
And so it creates a challenge for us.
Correct.
As we cross those boundaries, which is what we're trying to avoid with this type of arrangement.
That's correct. And as it is right now, with the process that we have, each city sets up their ambulance contract what meets their needs in their city.
Yeah, and then defines their own level, and maybe Tempe doesn't need that other need. Maybe they feel, and that's fine. That's their decision.
Exactly. And correct. And that's why we think the regional contract would help avoid that, because we'd all be working together on that. So thank you for explaining that, Mayor.
Go ahead.
Lastly, we did a comparison just to kind of see who else is doing a regional type of process here. It's a comparison by population, cities about the size of Mesa, just to get an idea of who else is doing a regional type contract. The majority of the cities run their own ambulance. The cities do that. But out of the private companies that are there, two of the four, which is both in California, Fresno and Oakland, they have what's a county type of approach. And that means the county is actually responsible for the ambulance services. So the majority of the communities within that county have the same ambulance company. So it's basically run as we do. So the neighboring communities have the same ambulance company. And I believe most of California has operated that way as well. So it has been done, not exactly like we're doing it, but the county oversees the process. Any questions?
No, Vice Mayor just pointed out that if we had the county operate it here, we could just take the patients to light rail and use them to transport it down.
That might be done. See, that's a good idea.
Save money that way.
All right, there you go.
Councilmember Richens.
Yeah.
As much of a fan of light rail as I am. A quick question about contracts between the four cities, the current contracts we have with our ambulance providers, when do those each expire? Do we have contractual obligations that overlap or don't line up?
They do. All the different entities are at different terms with their contract, but consistently they all have the provisions that with adequate notice those current agreements can be terminated. So what the idea would be that we're currently working together with the other three entities on a request for proposal process, and then as we would go through that process, we would provide sufficient time for each of the entities to give the required notices to the vendor of the termination of the existing agreements with the idea of moving into the new negotiated contract.
Okay. And how many ambulance companies are there in the universe, in the Maricopa County universe, that could respond to this RFP?
Chief, you want
Who's our potential vendors?
You know, right now we have two here in the Valley, Southwest Ambulance and PMT, but that doesn't discount other ambulance companies that may put in, once we put out this regional bid, others that might be interested and put in for this bidding process as well when we open up the RFP.
Does PMT, is PMT carries EMTs? Do they also have the capability of carrying paramedics?
Yes, some of their units in Scottsdale.
So they could provide the level of service that we're...
That's correct. Scottsdale has PMT as well as Tempe and half of Chandler.
Okay.
And then Southwest Ambulance has the four communities that we're talking about right now.
Oh, okay.
So
we all use... Yeah, that's right. You said... Okay. I'd like to make a motion to approve.
I don't know. Do we need a motion or just a direction, and then when the IGA comes back?
Yeah, so that's what we'll do, is that each of the cities are going forward, getting direction from their individual governing bodies to let them know, that kind of get a consent, a direction to move forward with this RFP. That obviously we'll have to bring that back, the terms of that proposal to the council in the future.
I mean, Ms. Spinner, would it be okay if we just gave the censor? Would it be better with a actual vote to?
Yeah, just directions, fine.
Okay. Is there anyone opposed to moving forward and giving direction to management to move ahead with this agreement? None? Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Jones, if you'd like us to experiment with the light rail, putting backboards on the top and transfer, we'll be happy to do that. Thank you very much.
Okay. Item number four on the agenda. Hear a presentation and discuss the four for Mesa. Was this item number four on the agenda by accident or was that planned? Four on four?
Quite creative, isn't that, Mayor?
It is. That's good. I like that.
I know.
I like that.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. My name's Natalie Lewis. With me today are Alex Deshek, who is the Manager of Innovation and Technology, and Gary Manning, who is our Human Resources Director. I'm the Assistant to the City Manager and also the Special Projects Manager. And as the Mayor started to point out, this has been a very special project. Before we move into some of the research and analysis that we have conducted on this program, and talk about how we're going to make this work for Mesa, I wanted to start off by just reminding us why we even started down this path and why we even thought about going this direction. And really, it stems back to one of our core missions as a city and as city government in providing outstanding customer services. And how do we provide customer services is through our people. And we know that despite this new economy and the financial challenges that are out there, it's our job to maximize our resources and to make absolutely sure that the resources we do have, that we are positioning them, realigning them, and making sure that we are doing the best that we can for our community to serve Mesa. We also know that satisfied employees, happy employees, provide better service. And so it was through this kind of discussion and the context of talking about limited services and how we were going to maximize those services that our employees made this suggestion. And they asked us to look into it. And they said, we think that the city might be able to save some money on some energy costs with a 410 type of a program. And we also think that it could be a benefit to the employees. And so please take a look at it as you are researching all different ways of realigning city services. And so we said, okay, we'll take a look at it. And we talked to Provo, Utah first. We were at an ICMA conference. We sat next to the city manager. Provo, Utah is a community that has used the 410 schedule for at least 5 years, maybe more. And he basically told us there's a lot of reasons that we ought to be looking into this. He suggested that, you know, the environment, there's environmental benefits, that environment's important to everyone. We, from the city perspective, could be removing around 3,000 employees off of our roads on Fridays. You know, that's reduced congestion, reduced pollution. He also told us that there was some real exciting news about extended customer services. We learned from him that not all services should go to a 410 schedule because you have to keep that balance and you have to keep that focus on customer service. But when you keep the essential services and the quality of life services in place, the more traditional or internal office services can go to a 410. And in fact, customers, a majority of them, would even consider that a benefit. He told us that energy savings, there is some potential for that. You're still open 40 hours a week. And so it's not the driver behind this, but there is some energy savings. There's things like custodial services that you can cut back on, and so there's some possible savings there. And of course, for employees, there's the commute savings aspect of it. But most compelling to him and his story is he said you just cannot underestimate the employee productivity and the retention tool and attracting employees to the city. He basically said there will be initial transition, there will be people that won't like this idea going into it, but once they make the change and the move and we get over that hump, most city employees really see this as a benefit and not a burden. But before we gave ourselves the permission to really give this even more serious consideration, we went out to our employees and we distributed and put out online a survey. And this was really just to get an initial pulse of where the organization was and just to gauge from them, you know, what are the impacts personally and professionally if we were to go in the direction of a 410 program. From the survey, and we asked lots of different questions, we asked it different ways, we asked it positively and negatively so that we were trying to make sure that we could really, people were reading the questions and giving us really good feedback. And generally about 70%, 7 out of 10 of our employees basically said, yeah, going to a 410, maybe that could increase employee morale and it could be a good thing for us. And so that just gave us the indication that we ought to continue moving forward with it. We also, though, did hear some concerns, and these are all valid concerns. We continue to hear them today, and we continue working with our employees as we move forward to the implementation date. And we've built in some flexibility options within the program that we're moving forward with. Things like, you know, we're talking about a Monday through Thursday with Friday off and a 6 a.m. to 7, or I'm sorry, yes, 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. People can come in a little earlier if they like and leave earlier. They can come in a little later and they can leave later. They can take reduced lunch hours. There's different alternatives. Some employees, we've been able to find alternative work locations for them on Fridays because they just can't work through some of those personal issues. Some of the issues are about community volunteering. You know, how am I going to be able to coach and help coach my kids' soccer team? And we've built into this program some flexibility with holiday hours. I'm not going to go into detail of how that's going to work, but the bottom line is through this, there's going to be some added holiday hours that employees can now use for these kinds of things in addition to personal hours that they can use for making sure that they're balancing their lives and the needs and the things that they want to do for their families. And of course, there's this extreme heat in the summer.
Natalie, just you made a comment there that maybe we ought to make sure isn't misconstrued. You said added holiday hours. We're not adding holidays to it, but the way the 410 works out and the application of those holiday hours. For example, if we have a Saturday holiday, and I don't want to get into too much detail, but as I understand it, if we have a holiday that falls on a Saturday, normally right now we would be shut down on a Friday and the employee would be given a holiday.
Correct.
Well, since we're already closed on Friday, then there's no holiday, but those hours for the holiday are still banked.
Correct.
And could be used during the year for things getting out early. So they could spread that out throughout the year because it's on a hourly basis, not on a day, designated day basis.
Yes, and thank you for that clarification.
So we're not adding to the holidays. It's just the way that it will function will enable more flexibility.
Yes.
And will actually, for the employee to be able to spread that entire holiday, that one day out literally throughout the year as he or she chooses.
And Mayor, we're also letting take the idea that you can break it up into hours.
Right.
So it doesn't have to be a full day.
Right.
Take.
Okay, so just make sure not additional but more flexibility, which creates
the same number of hours that employees get today will
right.
be the same during the 410 program.
Okay.
So thank you. For extreme summer heat and some of the field employees, we've also made some adjustments to how we were doing the 410 or suggesting the 410 so that during those time periods maybe they do work 5/8. And we're working very closely with the departments on that so that they can decide what's going to work best to deliver the services that the way we need to. So the why for this program and the why for Mesa has started to become more clear at this point. We knew we wanted to continue providing remarkable services within this context of limited resources. We wanted to find ways to increase productivity, enhance customer services. And we wanted to do this in a way where there was a majority of our customers and employees who would view it as a benefit and not a burden. And then, of course, we also want to enjoy some of the side benefits of being able to be green and possible energy savings that could go along with it. We did some additional research then, and BYU did a recent study, and they showed that 1 in 6 United States cities now offer flexible schedules to their employees. And we also looked locally because there, as you know, there's quite the movement right now for lots of different areas to move toward it, and they have different reasons for it. Some of them are even cutting hours. But generally what we heard from these communities is very positive reports, again, from an employee perspective and a customer perspective. Nationally, we learned that this is not only not a new trend, but it's a growing trend. We just simply do things and work differently today. Technology and the advances that it's provided us has given us a lot of abilities to do work outside of traditional hours. You know, when you have an extra 5 minutes, you pick up your BlackBerry and you respond, or you return a telephone call. There's things that we do today that we just didn't do before and that provide that kind of flexibility. And as we were talking to these cities across the nation, we kept hearing the same story. It was story after story of some compelling testimony, again, with employee retention and recruitment being a major factor. An advantage, extended customer service for internal and office types of functions for the majority of their citizens, seeing that as an advantage. They saw productivity and gains for their employees. They did see some energy savings. They liked the congestion reductions and the ability to really demonstrate that they were being environmental stewards. They also told us, again, there's early reticence in this. There's doubt. But once people became accustomed to this, the large majority really liked it, didn't want to look back. And then we did more research. And we learned about a BYU study that was conducted back in 2003. And this was performed in a rapidly growing community in the West that had adopted a 410 schedule for most of their city. So they had either 410s or 5.8s. And so what it did is it allowed the researchers to kind of compare the effect of a 410 employee versus a 5.8 employee. And basically what they found as it relates to job satisfaction and work-family conflict is those on a 410 schedule have lower levels of work-home conflict, and they do have increased job satisfaction. And we know that we can't overgeneralize this study for Mesa. It's not about Mesa, but it's another indicator as we continued our research in this. We also went to some research that Shift Work Solutions did, in particular about the productivity piece. And they basically have found in their studies that productivity can be maintained for most jobs. They found, again, that employees are frequently hesitant to work a longer shift at first, but once they get used to it, they rarely look back. There are some exceptions. Extreme heat or physical labor or being introduced to toxins are things that you have to work around, which is why we've made some adjustments in what we are proposing to move forward with. And so back to, you know, why we want to move forward with this and what our goals are and what we want to accomplish. There's still a major focus on customer service and a major focus on our employees. We want to retain the same accessibility to essential and quality of life services. We want to provide extended services for office hour types and internal services. We want to offer this ability to as many employees as possible. And then we'll adjust as we go through this, as we monitor and measure. And as we learn, we'll adjust as we need to. So how will we do this? What we are suggesting is for generally this group of employees that are within the quality of life and the essential services, there will generally not be any kind of a change, or it will be a little bit more of a flexible rotating 410s, different types of flexible schedules, and even some 5.8s. Again, the focus on customer service and making sure we're maintaining those things. So customers are still going to get their garbage and their recycling picked up every day. They're going to see police on the street. Our fire stations are going to stay open. They can go to the libraries with the hours that we have set. Our cultural facilities are going to be open. Those are major, you know, Fridays are big times for them. The convention center will be open. The parks and the community centers, all of those things will essentially be open. And, of course, water and sewer will be continued to move forward. For the 410 Monday through Thursday, 7 to 6, and the extended hours, it's mostly going to become what we're calling City Hall and Administrative Services, the more traditional office and internal services. So like the city clerk's office where people come in to register to vote, or human resources or information technology or finance or planning and engineering, with the exception there, again, because we've heard some very clear feedback from our customers that we need to maintain inspections on Fridays, and so we will be doing that. So the schedule for moving this pilot program forward is we've used January to brief our employees. We had earlier this month 4 meetings with our employees. I think we reached out or heard from at least 200 of them. We've made some shifts and changes just given that feedback. We're here with you today. February is when we're going to really bring this out to the community. There'll be news releases, there'll be signage at city facilities, we'll have stories in our open line utility bill, there'll be website announcements, Channel 11 scrolls, a possible survey of some kind in the future, probably some kind of staffing at the facilities that would be closed on Fridays during the month of March, so that people who don't hear the word, we're there, and at the very least, we're letting them know, if we can't serve you right now, we're going to facilitate getting that service to you on Monday, and letting them know about the new extended hours. March through November is monitoring and evaluation. And December, we'll come back to you with our recommendations on any changes that we need to make or adjustments, and basically direction for whether or not we think it's a smart idea to continue for 2010. So that kind of brings us back to the beginning.
I think Councilmember Calvin has, mm-hmm. Oh, no, you want to wait? Okay. Go ahead.
I'm almost there. We know that we have limited resources. We also know that it's our job to maximize those limited resources and to provide the service delivery. We don't think a 410 type of a schedule is a silver bullet for increasing employee morale and fixing a lot of issues that we do have, or any organization has. But from the research that we've conducted and listening to all of these different cities, we really believe that we are heading in the right direction.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Cavanaugh.
Thank you. Councilmember Summers and I attended the same briefing on this issue, and I think the staff is aware that we both have significant reservations about what you're proposing here. It's not that that we're against flexible schedules. Obviously, many employers do that, and I have no doubt that 1 in 6 cities in the survey may use flexible schedules, but I do question whether 1 in 6 cities has gone to a 4-day week in terms of closing city facilities. Those are different things, and so we need to keep that in mind. And at least the concerns that I have, and I know I think Councilmember Summers shares, is that this does have the potential to have a disproportionate impact on single parents. It has a potential for increased overtime costs for people who do have to work on Fridays because of whatever circumstances there are. I think we do have some questions and concerns over productivity in at least experience with other 410 schedules. I think there is a question in terms of whether productivity is there. I have no doubt that maybe morale may go up in some cases, but I have got some concerns about productivity. I think the biggest concern that we have is the impact on the community and in customer service, because I think we do have the potential to create confusion, because we would be the only level of government doing something like this, because state, county, federal offices will be open 5 days a week. School districts are open 5 days a week, and we will have a mixed bag of services. Some will be open, some will be not. And I think you have a very formidable education task to present to the community. I think the issue of the extended hours is maybe illusory for people to come in to do business by staying open till 6, because if you're working at your job and you get out at 5 and you're caught in the Phoenix area commute, you may arrive here in time to have 5 minutes of FaceTime with a city employee before we close at 6. And so I think that's a challenge. And so again, from my perspective, I think having a 4-day week will create some difficulties and challenges, primarily for our consumers or members of our community, but also I think it has the potential for some significant impact on employees. But I do appreciate the fact that you have acknowledged there are issues there and are seeking to find ways to minimize that input, and so I respect what you've done on that. Thank you, Mayor.
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple things I have. As it's presented as a benefit to employees, in my estimation, a benefit is something somebody would like, did we ever try a survey of opening it up to who would like to go on a 4-10 work schedule, and can we still function as a government with those people working at 4-10s? That's kind of a question out there. I know we haven't done that, and there's probably some issues, but if you found out that there weren't enough people, or that there were too many, or this department couldn't do that or that, I mean, we could negotiate that along that. Gary, you seem to...
Councilmember Higgins, at the moment, department directors already have the latitude of offering a 4-10 schedule or a 9-80 schedule. That really has never changed with the city. And in fact, we've taken a look at the number of non-sworn employees who are already on kind of a 4-10 schedule. And surprisingly, there are about 700 non-sworn employees already working a 4-10. So the 4-10 concept really is not new.
Let's 700 of non-sworn, and we have, what, about 2,000 sworn?
We've got about 3,500 full-time employees in total. Of that 3,500, we've
got
about
2,000.
There are about 1,200 that are
police
sworn.
Police and fire.
Oh, okay. 1,200 sworn employees.
I was adding the one to the other. So of the 3,500 full-time, we have 1,200 sworn, so that's 2,300. So 700 of the 2,300.
700 of those 2,300 are already working.
30% of our of our non-sworn employees are already working.
Us around 1,600 non-sworn employees who would have an opportunity to go to the 4-10, which, as I said, department heads have already had that latitude to be able to do that if they wanted to. This was just really an initiative to open that up a little bit further and provide more of that benefit across the city. And because there were a number of employees who requested that we take a careful look at it, as Natalie pointed out, I mean, that's why we did the research that we did. We did the survey that we did. We had 1,400 responses to that survey, which really is a pretty good response rate to it. We certainly recognize that there are going to continue to be a number of challenges and concerns about the 4-10. None of us are here to say that we are 100% convinced that it's the silver bullet that we're looking for. What we are suggesting is that if the experience that the other jurisdictions have had in going to the 4-10 program is any indication of what Mesa may expect, they're really fairly positive. And one of the things that I wanted to address with Councilmember Kavanaugh, in the study that was conducted by BYU, one of the things that caught my attention on here was, it says, quote, researchers found that 60% of employees reported higher productivity and 60% of residents reported improved citizen access. One of the things that the city did in Utah that this study was based off of, they were responding to citizens' interest in having extended hours, which, again, was one of the reasons they went to the 4-10.
Wow. I still have a couple. The things that concern me are out of the report that you gave. I mean, some of the positives are great. You know, people will have that day off. They can volunteer in their children's school. Those are great things. But the challenges are negative trade-offs to me that are concerned, because for employee basis is, again, I'm just going to read the bullet point that says, I'm speaking for the older generation when I say no to the 4-10s. It would be cause physical problems. I mean, I can sympathize with that being older. Another point was, I've tried a 10-hour work week previously and find them exhausting and find that my productivity goes down by the end of the day. And someone else said, please don't make this mandatory. There are some people who just can't do that. You know, when I see some of these, that's when I say, well, you know, you say it's open to everybody now, but we've not taken advantage of it. Well, how come the trial period isn't like, let's see who would like to do this? And there might be hundreds, and there might be a couple departments that say, no, we'd rather do the normal, you know, what's four, five eighths. But the point is, it would give the flexibility, because, you know, honestly, we're not going to be talking massive energy savings by closing a building, because it already sounds like certain people are going to be working certain places anyway. So why aren't we just saying, instead of it's across the board, this is what we're doing, say who would like to do it? Because, I mean, if it's a benefit, it'd be a great benefit, and people would, like, rush to it, which there are people that are like that, let's give them the benefit. But the people that are saying, no, it will hurt me and kill, you know, I'll be distraught, let's say, can we work around a normal schedule for you and find out where they are in the department? We're not dealing with millions of people. We're dealing with a couple thousand. Right. And find out who would like to do it and who wouldn't. And see, does that fit in your master plan for our organization? Does it meet the customer service needs? Does it meet our internal needs? All those needs. But I would have thought that would have been an easy question to ask. Okay. And I would love to know that. And is it only a handful? And is that handful able to be in a department where they could work a normal schedule? I don't know that.
Right.
Thank you.
I think administratively, Council and Mayor, that we looked at that, and there are those secondary goals. By having those flexible schedules, we would negate any of those secondary goals completely by really just saying, okay, we'll have pockets of folks working everywhere. And that's not the primary reason, but we didn't see this anywhere when we looked at it in other jurisdictions. It was either consistent work schedules or one or the other kind of consistent work schedules. We didn't see 410s or alternate work schedules split across 7 days. The five cities in the Valley we mentioned all are on 4-day work schedules, and they close city operations 1 day. So that's the model we looked at to start with, and maybe options, as I said, if we go through this, that's why we're proposing a pilot program at this point in time.
I'll just add one more thing, if I could. We're a professional organization, so it's not like we're manufacturing widgets or anything. So I think the flexibility exists in this plan to do some more of the things that I mentioned previously. And if your goal is to close the building, then we wouldn't be mentioning, oh, but some people will be working, 5 days a week. So there seems to be flexibility, but not flexibility. So the only true flexibility to me would be letting the employee choose and then deciding if it's possible. I know that some things might not work if you say, no, there's no way all those people could be not be on, or whatever might come up from that question.
Mayor, I appreciate that, and I think that's exactly what we're doing right now. We're trying to work with areas where there may need to be there are certain times of the year where there are different activities that take place that we need to adjust the schedules to. But also, because we are a service-oriented corporation, what we do, organization, there are the productivity also relies upon other functions being available and open. And so that's a consideration. And there's a reason that there's probably not more than 700 employees, because that's about all we can allow to do it at some point without really impacting what else is happening in the city. So I think we've met with all the departments. We've already gone through with them, and I think we've provided you the backup information to work with them on developing a plan. And where there are and needed for exceptions because of special circumstances for departments' activities or whatever it might be, constituent services or customer services, I think we've already made that accommodation that's been built into our business plan that we have here today in front of you. Really, we're just suggesting that in order to be effective, in order to do this on a larger scale, you really do have to have a larger participation. If we have too many different isolated pockets, then I really would frankly say we shouldn't do it, because then it creates a problem, I do think, of a disconnected processing and organization that you need to have. The way we work in this organization, we rely upon other units to be available and providing information and sharing information back and forth. So I think we've tried to accommodate that in the business plans as we've met with each of the departments. And so I think we've gotten that feedback, and we've tried to accommodate that through the process.
Can I ask Chris?
Councilmember Higgins.
So do we actually know what people have said they would like to work 410s? It kind of sounded like you did know that.
No, that's why we did the survey. We know that there were several.
We know that they like to, but I mean actual numbers, like out of the 2,300 people that will be moving to a 410 schedule, how many actually would like to do that now that we're putting it into effect? And how many would like to have
it? I guess that's...
It was a 72% rating of 700 people that responded, or 1,200?
1,400.
But we do have 2,300 non-sworn employees that will be affected.
Right.
Minus the 700. So, I know what we're saying. That's numbers.
But if 900 didn't respond to the survey... I would think they have no feelings one way or another.
This voter turnout in Mesa, right?
That's been a long survey.
I
mean, that we did. That was the reason. Like the, I think we've shared the survey with the council even before we put it out there, and that was really the test, was to find out and determine the interest in moving forward. Because it really, this came from the employees. As we were talking about budget cuts, as we were talking about 2% reduction, it consistently came up in the meetings about asking for the consideration to do this. And we followed that up with a survey. And I guess that's the other reason we were suggesting a pilot program, because I think Councilmember Kavanaugh raises some legitimate concerns. And we need to look at that as we go through here, both the customer service, productivity, employee morale, and those will certainly be addressed in the follow-up surveys. And frankly, they were addressed in the first survey, I think, to a large degree. And that purpose of that, there's no doubt that that first survey was intended to gauge interest as we were moving forward. It had already been discussed. So I think we took that a 70% favor on a survey from 1,400 employees as a pretty strong indicator of the interest to move forward. That's how we read it.
Councilman Richens?
I would have loved to have won my last election by 72%. I would take that as a pretty good mandate. But power goes to those.
Are you going to win your next election?
Probably. There will not be another election. But the power goes to those who show up and vote. Power goes to those who respond to surveys and answer questions that they get asked. And it's clearly, the people who responded to this survey had great interest in this. I think this is a fabulous idea. I like this kind of approach. I know it'll be awkward. It'll take a learning curve to figure out how to be closed on Fridays at City Hall. But from a sustainability standpoint, and from I would love to work 4 days a week, four 10-hour days. I work five 12-hour days right now, so I'd really like to have four 10s. But I'd really like to commend Natalie and Alex and HR, Gary, and everyone that's worked so hard and really trying to do a lot of outreach to figure out what's the real public opinion. And sure, there's going to be people that this affects in a negative way, and I'm sorry for that. But overwhelmingly, I think this will be a positive effect on the organization, and I'll have to get used to it. I mean, I know sometimes on Fridays I'll want to call our staff and ask questions, and we'll have to learn to live with that as well. And, you know, I'm willing and able to adjust to that kind of thing. So I just really appreciate the research that we've done on this issue and really tried to figure out the best way for this to work. This is, again, let's emphasize it is a pilot program to run towards the end of the year, and then we can reevaluate and see how it's worked. And if it doesn't work, we can always go back, or maybe we can find enhancements to make it work better. So I'm very much in support of this, and I think it's been a great idea. And I'm going to see if I can figure out how I can work 4 days a week, too, for 10 hours a day. But you have my support on this. Thanks.
Councilmember Finter?
Thanks. I'd like to echo Councilman Richens. Everything that he said. I had an exposure to this about 10, 15 years ago when in public safety the day staff personnel went to a 410 on a trial basis. And when it was suggested that we move away from it, there was an outcry from the employees. They loved it. And so that's been my exposure to it. And I appreciate all the positives have been going. I think a trial basis would be appropriate, and then see how it works out.
Okay. I also commend you for undertaking this. I recognize that that not everybody is going to be happy. You're going to have strong feelings both ways, and I think that as you weigh and try and balance the needs and the interests of the individual employees, which are absolutely important for the reasons you stated, Natalie, and thank you very much for bringing that up. That we are a service business. Government is in the service business, and therefore service to our customers, our citizens, and those who do business with us is the number one priority. And you get there by having a satisfied workforce. And so we need to do whatever we can to create that. We also need to do what we can to change the way that we've done business in the past. I mean, we're assuming that our current business model creates the greatest level of service, and I think that we need to explore different ways. I think Councilmember Kavanaugh, I would agree with everything he said about the challenges and the potential problems. I'd also point out that those who deal with the city, one of the biggest complaints I see is that those who work in 8 to 5 have no opportunity to come in and do business with the city except for to take significant time off of work to come in and work with the city because we're open the same times they're open. You know, the old banking hours kind of a scenario where it drives me crazy that I have to leave work to go to a bank. Why doesn't the bank stay open when I'm not working? And I think this gives our citizens an opportunity to work a normal schedule and perhaps take a little bit of time off to receive the kind of service they need. I also would be much more concerned if we were a total trailblazer in this area. I've read and studied many of the examples you brought up in different publications, and I think the thing that's interesting is that I have yet to find one municipality or state that moved this way that has had a negative experience. And I find that interesting because the naysayers would certainly show up, and I think you'd see an example. So when you have other entities and other government units that have moved to this, and it's almost across the board universal that the experience has been positive on an overall basis, then it seems like we should look toward those things that others have had success with. I know that there are individual issues. I know that there are problems. I know also that from running a large organization that it's very difficult to create a hodgepodge of service. And as flexible as you'd like to be in providing complete individual choice, that at some point in time, the needs of the smooth organization, it becomes counterproductive. And at some point in time, we've all at least got to be on the same page. So I'm a little bit reluctant to open it up to basically have a modified flex system. I'm anxious to see how this will work. I support your efforts, and I support moving toward this. And hopefully it's something that we can all adapt to and find it as an enhancement. If it's not an enhancement, if it doesn't create better service, if it doesn't create the savings in both energy and cost and those things that we envision, then we should not continue with it. But I think we should give it a try, simply because it appears to be the right thing to do at this time. And we have others who have shown us that we can be successful in not only enhancing employee satisfaction, but enhancing citizen satisfaction, which at the end of the day, as you've said, is our ultimate goal, to better serve our citizens. So.
Thank you for the feedback. We will be moving forward. We really want to get the word out for this next month so all our customers understand the changes we'll be making, and then this will take effect March 2nd is when we'll be putting into effect. And we'll come back to council and provide a report. Thank you.
Yeah, and let's once again let's keep close track of it because I'm sure we'll get plenty of feedback one way or another.
Thank you.
From all sides. Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda: acknowledge receipts of minutes from various boards and committees. Have a motion.
So moved.
Motion by the vice mayor, second by Councilmember Richens. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Number six: hear reports on meetings and/or conferences attended. Any reports? Okay. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just reminder to those members of council who are on the Community and Neighborhood Service Committee, there is a meeting following this study session, and we have a council meeting on Monday, February 2nd. And also want to continue to remind the council, I think we mentioned this last time, that on Wednesday, February 11th, there will be a joint meeting with the Dobson Ranch Homeowners Association. I need to correct the start time. I think I said 7 a.m. last time, 7:30 a.m. Does that sound better? Let's start. I believe it's 7:30 a.m. Start at the Landmark. And also want to make sure not only on behalf of the mayor and council, but remind everyone that you can have breakfast with the mayor on February 6th at the Mesa Hilton. And we want to encourage everyone to sign up for that. If you can contact the Mesa Chamber, and you actually register online at the mesachamber.org, and encourage you to sign up quickly to get your seat for that exciting event. We understand the heat will be turned up.
The heat will be turned up. We promise many exciting and wonderful things. And an hour of gastronomic delight and vivid entertainment and information download. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Crocker, do we have any requests from citizens to speak?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. Move for adjournment.
We have a motion to adjourn. Does that have a second? Second by Councilmember Fenter. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you so very much.